Yes, I know it's one below zero, but we're still going to be talking lawns and gardens like we do 52 weeks a year here on 830 WCCO. Denny Long here. Good morning to you, and good morning to Julie Wisenhorn from the U of M. Julie, hi. Happy New Year.
Hey, Happy New Year, Denny. How are you?
I'm doing quite well. I hope you are, too. I want to talk about how nice it must be having an office at the Arboretum. We'll get into that. But I'm looking, I was kind of glancing outside earlier. But here we go. No snow, very cold, sunny. This has happened before and we've talked about it. We've addressed it on this show. What can happen, not in a nice way, to our, maybe lawns are one thing, but what about our shrubs, things like that?
Well, hopefully people have a little bit of mulch around their shrubs, you know, a couple of inches, 2-3 inches. That mulch will help to moderate the soil temperatures and protect the roots from too much. They protect the soil from the frost getting too deep down into the soil, which can be detrimental to roots. Roots die at about 10 degrees, so we want to keep that soil above that, and that mulch helps to moderate that temperature and help to prevent that frost from going so deeply down that it damages the roots. So that's one thing. When we don't have snow cover, snow is a great mulch, actually. It's called poor man's mulch, and it helps to protect and insulate that soil. It's all about lowering stress and keeping things happening gradually in our gardens. Unfortunately, we did not go from 60 degrees days down to a zero day like today. So that's really shocking to plants. We've had a gradual freezing this year, and we did have some snow earlier, and hopefully we'll get some more. So I don't like winter when we don't have snow. It makes me really uncomfortable.
Yeah,
because it's part of winter in Minnesota, and there's a lot of great things to do in the winter, and you can't do it without the snow necessarily. So I'm looking forward to it from a personal standpoint, but from a protection standpoint, it's important for those plant roots.
Now, looking, Julie, at the forecast for the coming week, looks like it's going to be basically sunny. But cold. Now, does this cold sunshine make a difference? A dumb question, maybe. But I would think sunshine helps a little, but maybe not.
Yeah, so where winter sun becomes an issue is with our thin bark trees. These are our younger trees, maybe new trees that you've planted. They're crab apples, cherry, maple. They all have thinner bark. They haven't developed that big, beefy bark that's on our more mature trees. And what can happen is when we get this really intense winter sun, if it's shining on the side of the plant for a length of time, it can warm up the cells and create this activity, and these cells starting to activate. And then suddenly the sun will go down, or it will go behind a building or behind some trees, and that temperature in that plant tissue drops suddenly, and it can create something called frost cracks, where there's a big crack that's created in the bark of the plant. And that can cause issues in the future during the growing season, when we have insect issues, when there's bacteria or fungi, spores that are floating around, and that can cause some issues for the plant. So what we do is we want to protect those plants by putting a tree guard around them. These are white to reflect the sunlight. And then they also protect the plant from that heating up factor that winter sun promotes. So you can purchase these online. You can purchase them at a garden center, a nursery. They're white. They're either a corrugated tube that's slit down one side and you just kind of pop it around the tree. Or they're also a wrap, a plastic wrap that you can wrap. And that helps to, again, reflect that winter sunlight, that really intense sunlight.
Yeah. If you want to join in on the conversation, we'd love to hear from you. Any kind of a lawn or garden question. If you're just joining us, Julie Wisenhorn from the U of M is answering those questions the rest of the hour. But if you're a regular listener, you know how busy we tend to get. So don't wait. Call or text as soon as you have a question, 651-461-9226. Here is a text for you, Julie.
Okay.
This past year, texter says, an apple tree produced so heavily that the limbs almost touched the ground. When I prune, could I cut 3 or 4 feet off the big lateral branches?
You could. You could head them back, meaning that you do cut them back. But remember that when you do that, you're cutting the buds off for next year. So you're cutting off the flower buds. And that might reduce some of the production. Apple trees are interesting because some of them produce very heavily one year, and then they don't produce very much the second year. Honeycrisp is an example of this. And so this tree may have really produced last year, but you might not have that same issue this year. It's great that the texter is considering and thinking about pruning, because we do prune our fruit trees in the winter when the plant is dormant. And I think it's more important to look at the structure of the plant rather than necessarily these, unless you have unusually large limbs that are really stretching way out, you want to bring them in a little bit to kind of create a better form for the plant. We actually have three terrific videos on our yard and garden page under the fruit section, under apples, on how to prune your apple tree. So I would suggest the texter take a look at those first, and they might actually get some really good information on that issue, but also on pruning in general for apple trees.
You know, we talk from time to time about apples here and the U of M's work on that, but why is it that, that the U of M and Minnesota, this area, produces such great apples? How do we
well,
do
we
that?
We have really excellent researchers.
Yeah, that helps.
And plant breeders. You know, back in, I'm not good with my dates, but it's at least before in the 1900s, it was not believed that you could grow a decent apple in Minnesota. There's a lot of publications that breeders from other parts of the country were kind of dissing us and saying, you know, who can grow a great apple in Minnesota? No one, you know, that kind of thing. And thanks to some of our brilliant plant breeders like Peter Gideon and Dr. Harrelson, we actually have some really fantastic history of breeding apples, and we are really, really good at it. A lot of it has to do with breeding apples that do well in cold climates and that actually take advantage of the conditions, the growing conditions, to produce a lot of sugars and to produce a lot of crispness. And we are able to use DNA testing now to speed up the breeding of apples to really determine what are the good characteristics that a young tree may have and whether it's worth the many, many years of growing it out before we really actually get to taste any of the fruit. So it takes a long time to bring an apple to market. If you think about it, you have to start, first of all, with grafting or seeding, and then you have to grow the plant out. It has to get mature enough to produce apples, then you have to taste the apples, and then you have to produce the plant in quantity so that others can be growing it in their orchards or their backyards. So really fascinating videos also of interviews with people like Dr. Jim Luby and Dave Bedford, who's a research scientist, research and plant breeder, with the university, and I would suggest taking a look at some of those. They're going to be on some of the university sites.
I'll tell you
what. It's fun to read that.
Yeah, and a great winter time, especially with one below. It's great thinking about crisp apples. Julie, we have to take a quick break, but let's invite our listeners to join in here on the Lawn and Garden Show. Call Smart Garden, 651-461-9226. Right now in the Twin Cities, it's a minus one, one below zero, or looking to, for highs, if you want to call them that, near nine above. Right now, though, bundle up if you're heading out. It's a minus 15 wind chill, but our air temperature is minus one, one below zero from News Talk A3O. This is WCCO. Stay with us. And a good Saturday morning to you. Happy New Year from all of us here in A3O WCCO. We're in the midst of our Smart Garden Show. Thanks to Julie Weisenhorn from the U of M. Julie answering those lawn and garden questions today, either by phone or by text as usual, 651-461-9226. You want to call in, chat with Julie? Great. Otherwise, just send a text like other folks are doing as well. Julie, here's one that came in a bit ago. Texter says, I have a trellis that I like to grow nasturtiums on this summer. The trellis is right next to some perennials. I've read, Texter says, that nasturtiums attract aphids and repel pests, which is true. How would the perennials be affected?
Let's see. They attract pests and repel them. That's a unique feature of that plant. I have not seen aphids on nasturtiums. That's my personal anecdote. We grow them every year in the foodscape at the Arboretum, Laura and I. and we have not seen aphids on them. So I think it's a great idea to grow them on that trellis. They're a sun-loving plant. They're edible, both the leaves and the flowers. They have kind of a peppery flavor, so they're great to throw into a salad when you want a little punch. But I have not seen an issue with aphids, so I would say go ahead and give it a shot. Worst case scenario, they're annual plants, and you pull them out and put something else on that trellis.
Okay. You sent me I'm thinking about folks that they're interested in apples, like I was bringing up a bit ago.
Sure.
You sent me a website. What is that about?
So we have a great website at the University of Minnesota called Minnesota Hardy, and it is all about the plants that have been developed and released from the University of Minnesota. So super interesting, everything from agricultural crops to fruits and vegetables to flowers and shrubs and trees. It's a really fun place to look at the history of plant breeding. And the person who asked about apples, we were talking about apples earlier, there's an excellent page on apples, and it kind of gives a timeline for how long it takes to develop an apple, but also gives some good history about apple breeding in Minnesota. So I just wanted to pop that up there. It's Minhardy, MNHARDY. .umn.edu/apples. You can also just Google it, and it would come up. Just type Minnesota Hardy.
Now, having an office there at the Arboretum, you were close to the Apple House, and you have a chance to, which I think is closed now, though, right? I think
it's closed right now. Yeah, we're done now for the season.
What's your favorite apple? I've never asked you. It sounds like an interview question. What's your favorite apple?
Let me think a minute. Well, I'm a Sweet Tango fan.
Yeah.
I love Sweet Tangos just for plain eating. I like to cook with Harrelson apples. They're a tart apple, and they make a great pie. My mom believes in combining apples, in mixing apples into a pie, and she makes the best apple pie ever. But one of my very favorites, and it's kind of a little known apple, I think, for most apple eaters, is called Frostbite. And it is a cold hardy plant, cold hardy apple, and it's a smaller apple, and it has a unique flavor. I think I was describing it that tastes a little bit like kiwi fruit is with the apple, kind of mixed in there. It's a really, really good apple. It comes out late in the season. It's smaller, so if you don't like the really huge apples, which some of our apples are quite large, it's a nice size apple. It's probably about 4 bites if you have a big mouth like mine. So,
What's it called again?
It's called Frostbite.
Frostbite. Well, Frostbite. Certainly on a day like this, it applies.
Yeah, it's perfect.
How long has that been around? I've never heard of it.
That's an older apple, too. I'm not sure the year that it was released, but it's been around for quite a while. And I found out about it. I went to an apple tasting that Dave Bedford, our plant breeder, and I neglected to mention Dr. Matt Clark, who is head of our apple breeding program and is a terrific plant breeder in his own right. So he and Dave are out there working on apples and other fruits, but Dave Bedford did an apple tasting at the Arboretum many years ago. These crop up every once in a while, no pun intended. And I tasted the Frostbite, and I was like, wow, this is a really different tasting apple. And I've been a fan ever since.
Oh, I got to check that out.
Yeah.
You made me think back of many years ago, and we'll get back to the text in a moment. But we had a brief once-in-a-while garden show. My late friend and colleague Charlie Boone would have Dr. Leon Snyder on.
Yeah. He was our first director of the...
Oh, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Ah.
He was also a department head for horticultural science, too. So
yeah,
wrote a lot of great books.
That was a bit ago, a few years ago.
I have a book that he wrote that compiled questions from that garden show.
No kidding.
Yeah, I'll have to show that to you. It's just a paperback book. I don't think you can get it anywhere. I found it in my office when I moved in, so I don't know where it came from. But yeah, that was it's a pretty interesting thing. The questions are not that different.
Now, is his name? Can you see his name at the Arboretum somewhere? Is there a?
The Snyder Building is named after Dr. Snyder.
That's what it is.
That's our original visitor center, and now we have the Oswald Visitor Center, which is the big one with, you know, the two-story and everything. And the Snyder Building, interestingly, was designed by Edwin Lundy, who designed the Lutzen Lodge.
Oh, yeah.
He designed every, it's gorgeous. And if you visit our Anderson Horticultural Library in the Snyder Building at the Arboretum, you can read all about Edwin Lundy, and the librarians can tell you about some of the design elements in that building. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous building. And you start to look at things like the lighting that he designed also.
Well, that's another feature,
really cool.
another reason to get to the Arboretum. We'll talk about that in the next half hour or so before Julie leaves us. I'll tell you what let's do. I'm getting a bit of a signal here. Let's take a break. We're going to find out about that cold forecast. Then we'll come back, pick up on more calls and text messages here on our Smart Garden Show. Stay with us. News Talk 830 WCCO. And a good Saturday morning to you. Happy New Year. It is the 4th. It's the first Saturday of the brand new year. January 4. And we're in the midst of our Smart Garden Show. Denny Long here, along with Julie Weisenhorn from the U of M. We'll talk about more about the Arboretum in a moment or two. Great place, especially this time, any time of year. But I want to try to help out as many folks as we can this morning, Julie. Here's another text. How do I get rid of spider mites on the hibiscus plant I brought indoors this fall? Well, that happens.
Spider mites are tough, so they produce this really fine webbing, and they're very small, and they're sucking insects, and they create a stippling effect on leaves where they've been sucking out the juices of the leaves. They turn the leaves kind of a yellow or a pale green color with these tiny, tiny white dots. That's that stippling. The best thing to do for that you can do immediately is I would put that hibiscus in the shower and give it a really hard spray. To blast off any of the insects that you can. And then I would start by treating the plant. And I would treat it with a rotation of insecticidal soap, horticultural oil, and neem oil. So you can purchase these ready to go in spray bottles at your local garden center. And then you can start to rotate those. In other words, use first insecticidal soap and really douse all of the leaves, all the flowers, etc. Then go ahead and switch it up in a few days. Check for the pests. If you still see issues, then use the horticultural oil. And then wait a few days, and then use the neem oil. And by doing that, you get a rotation of effects, and you also get a chance to an opportunity to treat those plants for that pest. And we do have a good webpage on managing insect pests on houseplants, and it's under our houseplant section on our yard and garden page. That's at extension.umn.edu. It identifies a number of really common pests, including spider mites, and talks about what the issues are with them. The one thing about spider mites is they like hot, dry conditions. So if that plant is sitting next to a heat vent, for example, you're blowing hot air onto it, move it into a cooler location, and that will reduce the insect, kind of the make the environment less friendly for the insect.
Have a lawn or garden question? We welcome yours this morning, as usual, either by phone or by text, 651-461-9226. Another critter question. If gophers...
Oh, boy.
When I saw that initially, I thought we were going to talk about the gopher wind yesterday. But if the gophers have been digging below my flower beds, Texter says, and have made huge mounds, how will that affect those plants? Will it kill them?
Under the flower beds. So gophers are going to dig holes and tunnels under there. They are probably what will be affected. Well, what will be affected are the roots of the plant. Gophers tend to disturb the roots. They probably chew through the roots, eat the roots, and that could be an issue too. So I think what I would recommend is digging down and closing up those holes and kind of thinking about how to get rid of those gophers. You know, how inviting is your site for those gophers, first of all? And then second of all, if worst case scenario, take a look at our critter pages, our wildlife pages, and see if there's a way that you can treat. It's hard to treat for mammals. That's the problem. Nobody wants to put poison down and kill them. They just want them to leave their property. And so by making the environment as inhospitable as possible for those animals, getting rid of any kind of nesting areas, closing up those tunnels, maybe amending the soil to make it less, diggable, so to speak. Those are all just some ideas for that. I'd start with looking at the environment and see what you can do to change it.
Okay. This listener, Julie, is trying to overwinter a lavender plant. It's starting to dry out. Don't want to overwater. Any suggestions?
Lavender, I think, is quite difficult to overwinter because we have those really warm, dry environments in the winter, and that is what is causing it to dry out. You don't want to overwater, which, great. That's wonderful because that is one of the ways we can kill plants. I would say maybe try making sure that the pot is draining well. That's important. You could also prune it back. Maybe it's got a little bit too much foliage that it has to support. It may also just go dormant for the winter. Maybe put it in a cool location that it won't dry out as fast. It's another option too. I find it difficult. I'm not successful with rosemary or lavender through the winter. So if anybody's had good luck with it, any of the listeners, feel free to text or call in with your ideas.
Julie, as you know, we get new listeners here all the time, and I think maybe this, especially during the winter months, especially when cold weather like this, great reading, great access, and such great information on the university's website. You and your colleagues put so much work into that, extension.umn.edu. Tell us, I get there's so much stuff, but tell us what some of the things that we can find on there.
Well, we try to cover everything, and horticulture is a big, big area of information. So we start off with things like how to solve a problem, things about plant diseases, identification of insects, that kind of thing, and then finding plants. A lot of times people are reaching out to us to about plant selection. So we talk about flowers and houseplants and trees and shrubs, and we give people all sorts of resources for that. And then we also have a how-to section that gives growing guides and how to grow safe food. So this is about food safety, plants for pollinators, how to manage your soil and nutrients. And then a section that's near and dear to my heart is our landscape design section and our lawn care section, because this is that's the area that I work the most in. And so this gives you videos and information on plant selection, also on how to find a professional. If you need a lawn care professional, there's a great section on that too. And then our awesome, awesome master gardeners, who are our extension volunteers for horticulture. We have a section called Ask a Master Gardener, and learning about the Master Gardener program too, which is just about ready to start the new 2025 with, I think, over 500 or 600 interns who have applied. Wow. And been accepted into the program. Yeah, it's
a lot
really exciting.
Of interest.
Super exciting.
Interest.
So that's if you great. Don't get your questions answered on the show, you can go to Ask a Master Gardener. And there are Master Gardeners who are answering questions online for people. Last but not least is our Yard and Garden News, which gives current information. Right now we have information on cultivating your horticulture knowledge through a class called ProHort. ProHort is an online horticulture foundation class. It offers hands-on learning and garden inspiration for professionals, educators, and gardeners. And you can register still for that class up until January 12th. And there's a link to it on our webpage for Yard and Garden. And then we have a Yard and Garden checklist, too. Now, this is things that you can be doing in your garden or in your house with your houseplants right now, too. So lots of great information.
I should say. extension.umn.edu.
Right.
Texter says this: can we plant in the ground next spring the amaryllis bulb we got in red waxed round this Christmas? Had 7 big blooms. Want to keep it going next summer.
Well, those waxed amaryllis bulbs are something I'm super curious about. John, our turf educator, and Laura and I, we all have one wax bulb in our offices, and mine bloomed beautifully. I think theirs did too. And we are going to peel off that wax, and we are going to see if we can propagate these bulbs. And I would say definitely take off that wax, plant it up in a pot right now after it's done blooming, and then water it like you would a normal amaryllis, in the pot. And then next summer, put it in your garden and see if you can get it to bloom again. whatever you do with amaryllis is it's always beneficial to put them outside where they get full sun and they can really grow well through the entire summer season and put a lot of energy into that great big bulb for blooming for next year. So good information on our houseplants page on a page I wrote about amaryllis, including how to overwinter them. So go ahead and take a look at that. But yeah, definitely take off that wax and pot it up right now when it's done blooming and then pot it, put it in the garden next year.
You keep us posted on that research, will you?
Yeah.
That's okay.
It's going to be pretty unofficial.
Oh, that's all right. It's fun. This listener, Julie, says, I live in southwest Minnesota. In early December, the neighbor's steer got out and spent 2 weeks gorging itself on my lawn. It left behind a bunch of, quote, deposits. Is it safe for me to use the cattle manure on my vegetable garden? That's a first on this show.
I'm sorry to laugh, but we've never had a steer escapee on this show before. I thought I'd heard it all. It reminds me of a friend of mine who lives in Africa and has elephants in their community garden.
But, yeah, I remember you talking about
it. I think that the issue with the manure is it needs to be composted. So you need to scoop it up, put it in a pile in the back 40 of your property, and let it just break down. If you put manure on that's relatively fresh, it can burn your plants, and it can cause a really hot environment for plants. So I would say compost it and then use it next year. Plan to use it next year and maybe talk to your neighbor about a better fence too, because that's crazy.
Pretty well. All right. On that note, let's take a quick break and be right back. We have more text messages to take care of this morning. If you want to call in your question, that'd be great too. 651-461-9226. Right here on 830, this is WCCO. And we're back with more of our Smart Garden Show here on 830 WCCO, around every Saturday, in fact, in the 8 o'clock hour. This morning, Julie Weisenhorn from the U of M answering those very lawn and garden questions. We have a bunch yet, Julie.
Excellent.
Here's a comment that we were talking about apples. You were mentioning what your mom does with her apple pies.
Right.
This listener says, Viking apple, very tart and firm, makes great pies. Now, I've never heard of that.
I've heard of it, but I don't know much about it. I just kind of in passing, I heard of a Viking apple. I don't think it's a University of Minnesota, but that doesn't mean it's not a great apple.
So absolutely, yeah.
We have the best, but
there's no doubt. And how different, like Honeycrisp, for example, I guess I'm stating the obvious because it's a whole different territory from Washington State apples, good apples.
Yeah.
But they taste so different.
Yeah, so, and that has to do with the growing environment. So the temperatures and
it's
the
like
day
wine.
Length. And, yeah, it's all these different things. And you can grow the same apple in two different places and have it taste really remarkably different.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, yeah, I'm kind of an apple snob. I like to stick with the university apples. And I eat a lot of apples in the fall when they're here. And after that, it kind of peters out. So
yeah, I'm with you there. Nice listener says, Garden Talk, best program on CCO Radio.
Woohoo! Thank you for
Dr. that.
Shin.
Here's kind of an inside question, because it would Julie know, Texter says, where the beautiful wood furniture went that used to be in the atrium area outside the library, gorgeous wood couch and chairs. They were replaced a few years ago. You know anything about that?
I have no idea. It probably is either in storage or got moved to some other part of the building. I think I know what they're talking about. I'm not sure. That would be a question, I think, for somebody at the visitor center.
Another texter, we never planned on talking about apples this much. where or how do I find a frostbite apple, texter says?
Well, you can talk to a nursery. You can also just search for it online and see if you can find an apple, frostbite apple tree. But I always like to refer people to their local nursery and see if the nursery can get the plant for them. It's great to work with somebody, over and over and get to know them, and particularly the staff at your local garden centers are super knowledgeable. They often know what's working, what's doing well in plants for the area that you live in. And they have, the inside scoop on where to get a lot of plants. So start with your local nursery and ask them.
That's a good idea. Good morning, texter says. I watered my anthurium a week ago, drained it well. It's next to a southern window with plastic over the window. One leaf turned half yellow with a big gray spot on it. You have any idea why this happened?
Oh, boy. I think it sounds like it could be, let's see. So anthurium are where they grow as native plants. They grow as understory plants. So they're growing in kind of an indirect light condition. Maybe it's too much light for the plant. It might be, too, that they're, it's a leaf spot issue, which could be either fungal or bacterial. It's great that it drained well. I think that would probably be my two go-to question of what to do about it. I'm not really sure, except to maybe move the plant to a different location. Try that first. If it's just one leaf, I would just trim that leaf off. But if you start to see it on other leaves too, then it's something bigger than just like a sunburn kind of thing. So maybe try moving it first and see what see if that solves the issue.
All right, Julie, 2 minutes to go exactly, and a listener wants to know, we talk about the arboretum. How do we get there? They've never been there. Give us directions, and what's the process of finding the place and getting inside?
Well, I'm glad that you're looking for the arboretum. So the arboretum website is arb.umn.edu. And if you visit that site, you will find a link to plan your visit, and it will tell you how to get to the arboretum, the address, where it's located. It's on the west side of the metro, just past the intersection of 41 and 5. And you also need to get a pass to get in or a ticket to get in. If you become a member, the members don't pay to get in. But you do need a pass if you are not a member, and there's a daily fee for that. And kids under 15 or 12 get in for free. So great to bring kids. So go to the website, and you can find out what's going on at the Arboretum. There's a wellness fair coming up January 11th, which looks pretty cool. There's a lot of classes, awesome, awesome classes coming up, everything from food and culinary education to painting and art classes, and of course horticulture classes like pruning and propagating plants and design and all sorts of options like that. So many things. So visit the website at arb.umn.edu.
Absolutely. Julie, always a pleasure. Happy New Year to you and Carl and the rest of the gang there at the Arboretum. And I'm sure we'll talk in a couple of weeks or so.
Sounds good.
All right. Julie Weisenhorn from the U of M. Thank you, Julie.